Tennis star Arthur Ashe has written a history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. He says, discrimination, vilification, incarceration, dissipation, ruination, and ultimate despair have dogged the steps of the mightiest of these heroes. I spoke with Ashe about his own hard road to glory. Ashe started competing in tennis in the 1950s, when the courts in his home state of Virginia were still segregated, and the world of professional tennis was, for all practical purposes, a white world. Ashe became the first black man to win the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. His playing career ended at the age of 36 in 1980, after a heart attack and quadruple bypass surgery. Since that time, he served as captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team and national campaign chairman for the American Heart Association. Arthur Ashe has written several books, including an autobiography and a tennis diary called Portrait in Motion. He got drawn into writing a history of black athletes when he discovered how little was written on the subject. As he did his research, he came upon many stereotypes that have been used against blacks in sports.
The strongest health stereotype was in baseball. Mm-hmm. No question about that. Baseball emerged very quickly as the national pastime, followed closely by football after a while. But in baseball, the players and some owners went to great lengths to keep blacks out, and the stereotypical reason was that they were not good enough or were afraid. For instance, even in boxing, one of the reasons that Jim Corbett back in the late 1890s and John L. Sullivan gave for not fighting blacks is that they had a yellow streak. And obviously Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion, put all this to rest. But that was what people wanted to believe, and it was chiefly as a result of stereotypes publicized about in magazines and newspapers.
Now, you basically grew up on a sports field. Your father was a special police officer of the largest public park for blacks in Richmond, Virginia.
Correct.
Did that help get you interested in tennis? Were there tennis courts in this park?
Yes. There were four tennis courts at this 18-acre park, and we actually lived on this park, and there was also an Olympic-sized pool, a basketball court, a large utility field, three baseball diamonds, and two football fields. And that's where I grew up. So I was sort of totally immersed in sports as a child.
You've written that, like most blacks, you grew up believing that a lot of jobs were off-limits for blacks. What about sports, and specifically what about tennis?
Well, when I became 10, 11, 12 years old, we're talking about the early to mid-50s now, the color line had been broken in the major team sports. There was already a broken line of sorts in boxing and track, but it had not been broken until that period between 1946 and 1950 in basketball, football, baseball, tennis, golf, bowling, and some others. And so I was a sports nut as a child and able to follow the exploits of a Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. And in that respect, I was quite fortunate. But not knowing that had I been born just 2 or 3 years earlier, that would not have been the case.
How did tennis become your sport?
I was always a very good little athlete. I was fast and I was quick, but I was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going to play football. I wasn't tall enough to really do that well in basketball. I learned how to swim at a very early age, but was not that interested. Soccer was no longer, was not popular yet. And I also played tennis, I think, because it was not a team sport. It was just me by myself out there alone. And I also, in addition, believe that I gravitated towards sports and books as a way to get over the death of my mother, which occurred when I was just 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think books and sports may have saved me from going slightly nuts.
You've pointed out that when you were coming of age, blacks really had no identification with the sport of tennis. And I was wondering if that was ever an obstacle to your appreciation of the sport.
Not really. I knew who the black sports heroes were in the field of tennis. People like Jimmy McDaniel. Of course, we were all aware of Althea Gibson and very proud of her for having blazed the trail. And I knew some of the other very good black players. But all of us knew that we wanted to play at Forest Hills. I wanted to play in the Davis Cup. I wanted to play at Wimbledon. And in the late 40s, that was just not possible. But that didn't stop us from wanting to realize our dreams in any event.
Did anyone ever try to discourage you and tell you that there was very little room for black players in the sport?
No. Not discouragement to the extent of saying stop because there's only so high you can go. No. But it was certainly pointed out that there were no, with the exception of Althea, there were no black role models that you could point to that had gone as far as she had gone, especially no men. No men at all. Completely none.
It's funny because it's usually the opposite way, right?
Yes, yes, most sports. Yes, that's exactly right. But and it's still that way today. That is, to the extent that there may be more black participation in the sport, like tennis in the future, I think most of the participation in the next decade or so will be females rather than males.
If you're just joining us, my guest is tennis star Arthur Ashe, who retired from the sport a few years ago after quadruple bypass. He has just written a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete, and it's called A Hard Road to Glory. What was the world of black tennis like when you started to play?
Well, it was a very self-contained world, largely confined to the East Coast cities of Durham, North Carolina, Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Montclair, New Jersey, New York City, New Haven, Connecticut, Boston. There were some outposts in Wilberforce, Ohio. Any place in the South that had a black college was a mecca for black tennis. And Kansas City and Los Angeles. And, oh yes, those Houston and Dallas were meccas, and Prairie View, Texas, because that was the site of a rather large black college, Prairie View A&M. And those were the places where blacks congregated from year to year, summer to summer, to play and to socialize, meet one another. And that went on from 1916, and it continues until this very day.
Were there tournaments that you wanted to play in that you were barred from because of segregation?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. I was barred from all official sanctioned events in my home state. In fact, I only played in one sanctioned event in my home state as a junior player in my life. That was when I was 18, and I came back to play in the National Interscholastics, that is the national tournament for high school athletes. That was held in Charlottesville, Virginia in 1961. That's the only integrated or sanctioned event I ever played in my own home state as a junior.
Tennis is the sport perhaps most associated with the upper class, and I think that perhaps in black tennis and in white tennis, when you were starting out, that a lot of the players were from well-to-do families.
Yes, that also made a huge difference as far as tennis was concerned. I also think it has a lot to do with the longevity of the American Tennis Association, for instance, which is the black national body that has held black tennis together since 1916. I mean, the American Tennis Association has the longest history of any other black American sports body in continuous operation. The only other one would be the athletic conference that ties together the schools and the Central Intercollegiate Athletic Association, which was begun in 1912. But the reason I say this is implied in your question, and that is because most of the people who played were college graduates. They were members of the very small but influential black professional class.
Well, you are from the middle class, and your father was a police officer.
My family was lower middle class, and there's mm-hmm. no question. My father had a 6th grade education, but had a very respectable job, and we were not poor by any means.
But did that make you something of an outsider even in the world of black tennis?
No. Uh-huh. There was a pretty good mix, but almost all of the officers and the people who had positions of authority in black tennis in the American Tennis Association, almost all of them were college graduates. Almost all of them, and they all played. And they just saw to it that they were going to keep this group going, keep the tournaments going, and they did. But there were many players from other countries, for instance. There are a lot of Panamanians, black Panamanians, who came up to play. There are some from the Caribbean who came to play. And quite a few of those who are influential were first and second generation Americans from the West Indies. The West Indian influence was quite pronounced.
Because of the class associations with the game, when did you have to learn a certain code of behavior associated with the upper classes?
No, we adopted the same code of ethics that the white tennis body used, and that code was steeped in Victorian English tradition.
Uh-huh.
And we went along with it, but it made sense, especially since the principles that one would hear, the moral codes that one would hear in the black church would be very similar to what is espoused by Victorian England. Modesty, obey the Ten Commandments, honor your father and your mother, don't do anything that would embarrass your family. And I don't think black tennis players had any difficulty adhering to that.
You were the first black to win many of the titles that you won. You were the first black to win the Junior Davis Cup, the first black to get a UCLA tennis scholarship, the first black to win Wimbledon. I think the first also
black,
to win...
Black man.
Black man, okay, right.
Yes.
Also the same for the U.S. Open. What were some of the pressures that went along with being the first black or first black man to win some of these titles?
Well, the pressures were more closely associated with certain time periods.
Uh-huh.
I felt enormous pressure in the 60s because that was the decade of the era of the black social revolution. That's when Dr. King started his crusades, and you had your sit-ins and your freedom rides and summer trips to Selma, Alabama, and you had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act coming into being in 64 and 65. And Malcolm X was in his heyday, the Vietnam War, and Muhammad Ali refusing to cross the line for induction to the U.S. Army, and Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists at Mexico City at the Olympics. So against the background, the context of the 1960s, I felt enormous pressure to contribute to black social progress. In the 1970s, it all but disappeared. Any pressure one may have felt then, anybody black may have felt, was self-inflicted, self-imposed almost. It just completely disappeared. And now there's very little pressure to do anything, especially when compared with the era of the 1960s.
Do you think that's good or bad?
Well...
Or neither.
I'm sort of ambivalent about it.
Uh-huh.
There's no question I think it helped. No matter who you were or what endeavor your expertise was in, if you had any degree of fame at all, you were expected to participate in the 1960s. And you were even badgered into it almost, in ways of trying to prove that you were blacker than somebody else. You know, your afro was bigger than your dashiki was more African than the next black person's. That just completely disappeared in the 70s. And I can't find it at all in the 80s. And we know the reasons, but it's just sad to see it completely disappear because everybody now seems a bit more self-centered than they were before.
Mm-hmm. So you think some of those pressures that went along with the 60s were somewhat superficial, but on the other hand, you wish things were a little more political today?
Well, not so much superficial as someone like myself and quite a few people being in a position where if you were from the South, you were legally proscribed from doing a lot of things by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And here you were in the 60s being pressured into doing things by blacks who were in so-called leaders, positions of responsibility and influence. And you came to the point where you wanted to ask yourself, well, when do I get a chance to make up my own mind about something?
Uh-huh.
That's the situation I felt most deeply. All my life, up until I left school to go to college in California, I had whites telling me what I could and could not do, where I could and could not go. And all of a sudden, in the decade of the 60s, you have your black militants and other black leaders telling me what I should do solely because I'm black. And again, I would like to be able to make that decision for myself if I could once in life. But as far as tennis was concerned, for instance, the one area where I felt this tug both ways was in the issue of dealing with South Africa.
Yeah.
I was told in 1968 that if I wanted to go play in the South African Open, they probably wouldn't let me go because they don't allow blacks to play down there. Now, that had happened to me all my life as a junior in my own hometown, and I was in the position of saying, well, I'll be damned if that'll happen to me as a senior player. And when I wanted to go down there, you run into the opposition by some other blacks who say, you can't go down there because if you do, you'll be lending credence and credibility to that system. But I was just trying to prove a point that, hey, here's a country that said I can't play, and my position was, you either let me play or your tournament doesn't count. One of the two. Take your pick.
Mm-hmm. Athletes really have to be very single-minded to develop their abilities. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to figure out how to divide your energies between civil rights actions that you participated in or speaking out on behalf of certain issues and devoting your time to your sport.
Very difficult, very difficult. I got in trouble once when I was stationed at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I was an officer there and second lieutenant, and I made a speech in a black church in Washington that the Army thought was a bit too political. It was covered in the Washington Post, and I was called into the superintendent's office and told in no uncertain terms that if you do that again, you're going to be grounded, meaning we wouldn't be allowed to go out to play Davis Cup or whatever. Yet, you felt almost duty-bound to say something. Things were at such a fever pitch in 1968. That was the year, of course, when Dr. King was assassinated. That's when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. That's when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists. And looking back on it, I don't regret it at all, even though I know Army regulations forbid anybody in the Army from engaging in political activity. But you just felt almost compelled to say something.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your life in tennis and your life since retiring from tennis. But first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Arthur Ashe, who has just written a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete. It's called A Hard Road to Glory. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Arthur Ashe has just completed a 3-volume history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. Ashe himself is one of those athletes to travel that hard road to glory. He was the first black American male to win Wimbledon and to win many other tennis championships. He retired from playing in 1980 after quadruple bypass surgery. You've pointed out in your autobiography that when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in tennis, when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, there were a lot of black baseball players who were already excellent players playing in the black leagues and waiting to break in. So there was just the gates opened and there were great players right afterwards. But in tennis, it was different. There weren't as many black tennis players. So after you helped break the color barrier, there weren't as many black tennis players coming right in.
No, there weren't. In actual fact, to go back to the first half of your question, there were many more black, talented, capable players who could have played in the major leagues than were allowed to play. The major leagues let in black players after Jackie Robinson almost as if they were coming through a sieve. It was very, very slow. The first 14 years could be best described as token integration of the major leagues. Now, in tennis, there were two problems. One is that there was no huge black American history of having quite a few heroes, say like a Satchel Paige or Josh Gibson or Oscar Charleston, that the average black American had known about as far as baseball was concerned. There was no one who had tested their skills against white tennis players, and it was publicized in the paper. You have to remember that at the end of each season, for a long time, all-star aggregations of white major league players would get together and play against black teams to full houses around the country. And in most of these confrontations, the black teams almost inevitably won. And it garnered tremendous publicity, positive, for the black players. Now, that never happened in tennis, with the exception of one time in 1938, Don Budge came to Harlem to the Cosmopolitan Tennis Club and played an exhibition match against our current black champion, Jimmy McDaniel. And Budge won very handily and then played a doubles match afterwards. But that's the only instance where the best black players played at a very public venue against the best white players. And as such, black America just was never able to establish the momentum to produce enough tennis players to follow right behind Althea Gibson when she opened the door in 1950.
Well, I'm thinking, too, for instance, like all schoolyards have basketball hoops, you know, and in most schoolyards or in vacant lots, you can play baseball. There aren't that many tennis courts around in cities, especially, I think that's true, in black neighborhoods.
Well, there are tennis courts, but most of the expertise and the competitions are oriented toward the other team sports. And there's one very strong reason for that. And that is because those are the sports that are stressed in the public school systems.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools have four major sports: football, basketball, baseball, and track. All but track are team sports per se. Track is organized and run as a team competition, when in fact the performances are by individuals. And one of the reasons to do that, the chief reason, is that it's the best use of scarce athletic space. Now, a tennis court is 120 by 60, and you only get two people on it, and it takes a lot of space. So unless you live in Texas or California or Arizona where there's a lot of space, that's just not going to happen in a place like New York City,
mm-hmm.
where you have to resort to private facilities. And the best teaching is not to be found at your public park or your public school, as it is for basketball or baseball. It's to be found at a private club, which means you've got to pay for it. And when you have to pay for it, that in effect becomes a barrier, an economic barrier to progress.
You gave up tennis in 1980 after
Yes.
a heart attack and then quadruple bypass surgery. What are you able to do now athletically?
Oh, I stay fit. I mean, if one were to see me in person, I don't look any bigger than I did in 1980. I ride an exercise bike. I think the athlete in me left enough vanity for me not to get a pot belly or to get completely out of shape aerobically. So I'm still looking about the same as I did then.
You've said that you've worked for the Heart Association.
Yes,
headed up a campaign for them. Yeah,
right.
Well, you've said that most people who die of heart attacks die because haven't gotten quick enough attention. They deny they're having a heart attack. They think it's indigestion or something. That's actually what happened to you.
Yes, if that is exactly what happened to me. And if it hadn't been for the doctor there, Dr. Lee Wallace, who just noticed my discomfort and asked some questions, I may have just sat there and died in the chair, for all I know. But he just very politely but firmly insisted that I come to the hospital with him, never mentioning the phrase heart attack at all. And, of course, we found out 2 days later, after they've done the enzyme tests and got the results back, that I indeed had had a heart attack. But, yes, in my work with the American Heart Association, it is stressed by cardiologists all over the country that the key to surviving a heart attack is not to deny that you have it, but get to a hospital, emergency room, and if there are no trauma cases, no gunshot wounds or knifings on the table, heart attack suspects go right to the front of the line.
Did you feel mentally prepared to retire from tennis?
Oh, yes. I was 36 years old, so it's not as if I felt cheated by this physical disability. No, not at all. I was probably going to retire at the end of that year anyway.
After you had become an athlete hero in the United States after winning Wimbledon, your value as a you became a symbol, and you became an important speaker. You became a symbol of of great athletic abilities, you became a symbol to the black community. And you once wrote in your autobiography that groups started to get angry if you turned them down. And people would say, how can you not come to talk to my group? How can you deny these children the opportunity to meet in the flesh one of their great heroes?
Right.
How did you deal with those pressures?
Those were very difficult. And I tell you, it's a problem that wasn't just peculiar to athletes. Imagine what someone like a Bill Cosby or an Eddie Murphy or an Oprah Winfrey has to go through. They must receive dozens of requests per day. And we received our fair share of them. And you just cannot accept every single one of them, although you would like to be able to help out. But in the context of the seriousness with which people viewed their problems, and the fact that they always ask probably more than one black notable, they keep getting turned down. They start to think that these black notables don't want anything to do with them. And that is not the case at all. But if you're an athlete, you've got to have some semblance of single-mindedness about your work. And to that extent, you've just got to say no. And I certainly said yes more than my fair share of time. So I don't feel at all guilty about not having accepted a fair number of those engagements.
I have to point out that in your history of the African-American athlete, there's a chapter on you. Was that one hard to write?
No.
You've been doing all this research on other people.
No, very easy. And I wrote it in the third person, and no, it was very easy. And I just tried to stick to the facts and write it the way I wrote any all the others.
One last thing. Can you still play tennis?
Oh, I can, but I don't. I hardly ever play. My wife will drag me out every once in a while and play, and I'll tell you one thing about it, though. Your hands and your arms never forget. If someone were to just casually watch me play now, and I may play twice a year, you would think that I never stopped playing. But once they see me run, they'll understand that I've stopped a long time ago.
Do you not play for health reasons or for other reasons?
Basically health reasons. My heart situation is such that I really can't fully go all out to play. So if I can't do that, then I'd rather just not play at all.